Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview people who are making a positive difference in the world. We explore important areas and aspects of life, including business, sales, physical, mental, relationships, disabilities, and many more important and interesting topics. Our broadcast team so far consists of outstanding people from both Canada and the U.S., including several Napoleon Hill certified instructors, as well as authors. My name is Tom Tutall Cunningham, and I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. I'm also a regular contributor to their weekly newsletter. I spoke in March of 2012 at the Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia, where I shared the stage with Deepak Chopra, who is the keynote speaker for that event. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. That's 44 years now, and I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced, which makes me sound like a spider, and then I've been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1". That's due to the heavy daily doses of the oral steroid prednisone that I had to take to fight my arthritis. Despite those physical challenges, I'm very well known for always answering amazing when asked how I'm doing. I'm a senior research director for the Canadian Business Journal, which is a digital-only publication. We are the official and only media partner of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. You can find us online at cbj.ca. You can find out more about me at my website. It's tall.com. My guest today is Corinne Sandler. She's the founder and CEO of Fresh Intelligence Research Corporation, an intelligence-gathering company that empowers decision-makers with immediate, actionable, and innovative market research. Fresh Intelligence is recognized by Fortune 500 companies for fast turnarounds, innovative research methodology, and a commitment to solving client needs. Founded in 2004, Corinne has spearheaded Fresh Intelligence to incredible success. For instance, 453% growth in 2011, which led to the company being ranked number 20 on Profit Magazine's Hot 50 in 2012. Corinne is also the only female CEO in the list's top 20 and one of only 3 women on the entire list. Corinne was voted one of Women's Post's top 20 women to watch in 2012 and was voted best presenter at the ESOMAR Global Conference in Berlin in 2011. She is a finalist in the 2012 RBC Canadian Top Entrepreneur Awards and ranked 20th in this year's 14th annual W100 ranking of Canada's top female entrepreneurs produced by Profit Magazine and Chatelaine. She sits on the advisory board of the Humber College Research Program and is a Path to Purchase Institute faculty member in the USA. With over 20 years' experience, Corinne has established a reputation for unparalleled customer understanding and insight development. She has worked with some of the world's finest companies such as Sun Life, Financial, Nestle, Pepsi, and Disney, and their market-leading products and brands to develop innovative, sustainable, and profitable consumer, brand, corporate, and trade strategies for diverse industries and product categories. Corinne is a visionary in her field, constantly pushing boundaries in product development to enhance the industry she is so passionate about. She's a recognized leader and a highly sought-after, passionate speaker around the world, covering numerous topics, including No War in the World Has Been Won Without Intelligence, sold through the Retail Council of Canada in Toronto and Vancouver, The Magical Effects of Insight, and various other interesting articles. She's other speaking engagements include the ESOMAR Annual Congress in Toronto in 2011, She's also an expert guest writer, writing regular columns for Strategy and Marketing Magazine, and she writes regularly for VUE, official publication of the MRIIA, which is the Market Research and Intelligence Association. Welcome to the show today, Corinne.
Hi, thank you, Tom.
Wow, that is a long list of accomplishments. And the one I found you on, because I was going to do some feature stories on companies, was that top female entrepreneurs in Canada. What an honor that is.
It rather is, and it's all kind of happened in the last few months, a number of awards. So I said it's great to recognize for what we love to do.
Exactly. And talking about loving to do, that is Napoleon Hill's number one success principle, is find your definite purpose in life and then pursue it with passion. And how long is it that you've known that you would be an entrepreneur, a business owner? Has this been in your blood since you were young, or has it gradually come upon you?
I think I've always known it. I mean, at the age of seven, when most kids are playing house, I was playing office. And so it kind of was for sure in my blood. But being, I immigrated almost 20 years ago. And when you immigrate, you kind of start from the beginning again and needed to get, a large amount of North American experience. But it was absolutely in my blood. It was no doubt that I would, do something on my own. But I needed to get the experience and truly understand a new marketing environment before I could actually set out and do it.
And you've done that. Your company is, to work with Fortune 500 companies, you have to be top in your class as a company yourself, because they have lots of options of people to work with. Now, when you were starting your company, Napoleon Hill talks about a mastermind alliance where you work with two or three or four people, maybe not even necessarily employees of the company, but people who you really respect their advice, their wisdom, their business acumen. Did you have some of these great mentors and mastermind partners when you're trying to put together your own company in a country that's not where you were born in?
Absolutely. I think every successful entrepreneur needs to have a successful mentor behind them, someone to guide them and learn from. And I did. I mean, my business partner actually is Tony Chapman, who is a marketing maven. He's in the Marketing Hall of Fame. He has owned and started and sold many marketing, advertising, and communication agencies over the years, and very smart businessman at that, for that matter. So he was, without a doubt, definitely a mentor for me and still is. He has no true, real understanding of the methodologies and the analytics behind research and what my company does, but he's a very, very inspiring visionary and great businessman. So he was and still is very much a business advisor to me today.
And isn't it important to have those people in your life and who don't necessarily work for you and who are recognized on their own, because sometimes they would have to maybe even disagree with you or point out different things that they might do differently, rather than someone who works for you is more likely to say, yeah, that I agree with you. We should do what you say.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But even on that point, I always make sure that I hire people that won't just agree with me because of who I might be within the company. For me, it's important to be disagreed on and have someone to have an opinion, but to be able to back up that opinion, So,
yeah.
It works both ways. But yes, I mean, the what I love about having a mentor and someone like I do have is the fact that you have the support, and it's kind of saying, okay, I'm going to invest here and I'm going to do this. And you kind of get that head nod to say, yep, go for it. And that's support and credibility within the industry coming from someone who has done it and been there and knows the risks and the rewards really provides the most amount of grounding in terms of my decision making.
And that's so valuable to have. Now, can you explain a little bit about, like, what kind of research would you do on behalf of companies that would be so valuable for them and their marketing team? What kind of projects would you work on? What kind of research would you gather for them? Because in this day and age, gathering data and making sense out of it is a huge, huge thing for companies.
Oh, absolutely, it is. And I think that, I mean, my book, No War in the World is One Without Intelligence, which is coming out next year, we'll talk about that. We're truly living in war. I mean, every organization, brand, business, person, etc., we are fighting for market share. And as we're fighting for market share, competition is getting tighter. So it truly is a war out there, and the only way to truly win is to have intelligence. And to your point, Tom, there's so much data out there, and data is meaningless. Data, really, big data is absolutely meaningless without the intelligence or without the insights, the true penetrating truths that are actionable, that companies can help empower them to make a decision, that can transform their business, etc. So we definitely play a role of an enabler, not a service provider. You know, here's your research, but more of an intelligence.
Yeah.
Gathering group and enabling you to make the right decisions, to grow your business and to contribute, you know, to your success through insights and intelligence. So to answer your question, I mean, we do a number of different types of research projects, but, you know, if we take, for example, you know, creative pretesting, a company spend millions of dollars on mass media creative and it goes into the market without it being tested properly. Now, what we would do is we could do what we call pre-testing creative. So we would test storyboards or a number of different concepts and be able to tell the client and the agency through workshops what needs to be improved to get that creative to truly, truly break through, to truly get your return on the investment that you're investing in, to truly get, target the right consumer, to be able to also, be able to tell them how this will motivate them. Are there any barriers we need to overcome? What content the message will portray, how to emotionally connect with them through this advertising or this creative. So we measure multiple different metrics, which all lead up to basically saying, you know, these are all descriptive analytics. This is the best way to change your creative to hit these marks and predict the return of that. That is one example of what we would provide back to our clients. So optimization, not this creative is good or no good. It's how to make it absolutely the best to hit those key creative objectives and points that will deliver the ROI that you need based on this investment.
Wow. So do you, like, I know with Fortune 500 companies, any ad that they put either online, on TV, on radio, most of them work with some sort of advertising firm or what, however you want to term their company, that puts together their creative ads. So do you do a lot of the work with also the companies that these Fortune 500 companies work with to make sure that their message is getting to the right audience?
Of course. On the creative testing side, whether it's, you know, pre-testing or final stage testing, we do work a lot with their creative agencies because they are the ones creating the ad. So when we deliver results back and workshops back, we want to work with them to show them the best way to optimize their creative positioning. So, yes, very much so. They are very much part of the creative testing process.
Is that hard to work with? Because creative people don't always understand statistics and intelligence, and often the statistic gatherer doesn't really their forte isn't on the creative side. So, is it sometimes challenging for both of them to bring their insights to the table and for you all to understand and agree on, okay, yeah, this is the best way to do it?
That's a brilliant question, Tom, and that's so true. Yes, the answer is yes. When we first started, many years ago doing the creative testing models and some agencies still work you know, to this day, they would deliver reports back basically saying go and don't go. Go meaning, yep, you know, you've hit the benchmark, you can launch this, or don't go, you haven't hit, you know, the benchmark, it'll fairly market. And that approach was very hard-hitting for the agency people because creative people are very opinionated. They take it very personally because it's their work. And we thought,
yes,
it's really not the right way to deliver you know, quantitative data or qualitative data for that matter. The best way to do it is to work with them to optimize. And that's the different approach that we take. So we will sit with them and say, you know, if you change this to that, or if you, you know, focus more on this than that, et cetera, we can optimize it to be the ultimate advertising vehicle or media vehicle or content messaging. Things like we would do a scene-by-scene analysis. So, for example, if the emotional objective they wanted to convey was excitement, we'd be able to tell them at what point in the ad do you convey the most amount of excitement, and then optimize that in terms of if the objective was to drive in store through excitement, we would tell them, well, maybe you need to change, you know, the screenplay to more towards the end or towards the beginning. So it's really
right.
about delivering it back to optimize their work as opposed to critique their work, and that's the key to working with them.
Wow, and then when you use a cooperative approach like that with them where you say, yeah, this is tremendous, but if you want to hit these specific emotions, augment this part and then do a little bit of this. So you're working with what they have created and honoring their work, but at the same time saying this is where the emotional highs and the emotional lows are in what you've put together and measuring that. That must mean a lot to them because then they know, okay, here's what's really hitting in this and focus on this a bit more and on this a bit less. And so it makes them way more receptive to your work than just a yes, this is good, or no, this is not good.
And at the end of the day, we are all working towards having the best possible creative out there to contribute to our client's success. And you know, working as an insight partner and as a team member with our clients and agencies is you know, it's a win-win situation for all.
Exactly. And now it seems that I've read numerous debates on marketing where a lot of ads or marketing companies or ads are designed solely to generate brand awareness or company awareness or product awareness, where a lot of other people would argue that marketing's job and these ads are designed to generate leads for the company, generate feedback, generate comments, generate leads. Do you work with both camps where people are just trying to get out a unique message that people will remember, as well as companies that say, this is designed not only for people to remember, but for us to increase business or get leads or you know, generate a new market for our product, that kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, creative and copy testing is just one aspect of the work we do. And every client has a very definitive objective when they're going to brief a creative agency on how to design or develop or you know, their create their advertising from scratch. So, you know, it could be you know, awareness or help brand equity measures, top of mind awareness, recognition, recall. It could be acquisition of new clients. It could be to combat competition. You know, it could be a PR initiative. I mean, there are so many different objectives. And you know, today, seeing more and more money being spent on the digital realm. You know, digital creative has multiple different other areas in which we can target in terms of, you know, retention and acquiring, most importantly, you know, new people and franchises into their brand.
Yes, which is so important for people, and measuring the results of marketing and a spend on marketing is very important, as well as the pre-testing. You want to see after it airs, measure it somehow so that you can say, boy, this really generated the result or the metric that we were reaching for, or maybe it didn't hit the target so well. Now, Corinne, I think of this, being a woman entrepreneur, for instance, and I forget the exact thing, I know when my mom and dad got divorced and there was a fair bit of money, so my mom had money after she went to do something with a bank, and they told her no, and it was surprising to her. So as a woman entrepreneur, have you in Canada, have you received a great reception? Is it, have you had challenges that you had thought, hey, I don't think men have these challenges? or has it been a really good experience for you, and have people really encouraged you and treated you just like any entrepreneur with an amazing idea?
I think I've been quite fortunate, and I think living in you know, today's world and today's times, and especially in Canada, nobody should really be coming up against those kind of discrepancies in terms of gender. I've had no issues whatsoever. Maybe if anything, quite the opposite. You know, more respect for the fact that, you know, he has a single mother with four kids and working and then being able to be successful in terms of what I do. So I have definitely not experienced any of that at all.
Wow. And this is, if I tell anybody who'll listen, my favorite people in the world that contribute the most to society and yet have the hardest time are single mothers. So mm-hmm. you mentioned single mother, four kids. That's not just one or two kids. That's four kids. Is it hard, or was there some kind of agreement that you had to make with your kids or involve them in your kind of mastermind group that, yeah, mom has a, you know, fairly busy business. Mm-hmm. I won't be able to always be home, and so you got to look after this one. You got to help me doing this. Have you been able to involve them and also explain to them that when you're the CEO of a growing, a fast growing company, that there are trade offs you're going to have to make with your kids?
There is. They have to understand that, you know, you are only one person, and you can only do so much. But what I do find, to be quite honest, is that the time I do spend with them is very high quality time. And, you know, I'm a firm believer it's not about the quantity. It truly is about the quality. So I might, you know, spend 2 hours in the evening with them as opposed to all day. But that 2 hours is very intense 2 hours where they have my full attention and nothing else. They also do, you know, I do involve them a lot in terms of, you know, I talk to them a lot about my work and about my clients, and I make it fun for them to understand. I do travel as well, so I have a lot of help, and they do understand and respect that. They also know that I'm always at the end of the phone, and I'm always there. You know, the same thing goes with, you know, my son's very involved in hockey, and I try and be at all the games, but he understands if mom can't be, you know, 20% of the games I might not be at. Mm-hmm. And it's just give and take. It truly is. You know, I think what kids need most in life is stability and to know that there's always someone there for them. And whether it might not be physical presence 24/7, it's someone, you know, at the end of the phone, or I could be there within 1 second if need be. And that's really the most important thing that they truly need. For me personally, I could not be a stay-at-home mom. I don't think I'm that kind of person, and I don't think that my kids are any worse off than anyone else, for that matter. I think that they learn to be independent, and I think they also learn a lot of respect for the person in their life that works hard and to give them what they need.
Exactly, and I think that's the epitome of single mothers. They have to work hard to support their family, and they have to be a mother, and both of those are very difficult tasks, and combining the two is incredible. And I imagine they also learn that you don't have to rely on a company or a job to create your future. You can create your own company or your own job, because they've seen you do that yourself.
Well, it's something I kind of always instill in them. And you know, I've always said to them, you know, you can do anything you want in life, but do it with enthusiasm. Because if you're passionate about something and you're enthusiastic about it, you will be successful. So my youngest daughter wants to be a baker, and I'm like, that's great. Go and be a baker, but be the best baker you can, you know, and put everything
into
it.
And this is so important.
Exactly, and that's the message I actually came home. I'll tell you a great story. On the weekend, I had come home from gym, and I said to my oldest daughter, I said, "Wow, I worked hard at gym today." And she said, "Mom, you work hard at everything." And I thought that was really a great message to hear from her, because that's the message you want to convey to your kids, you know. Work hard at everything. Work hard at school. Work hard at your friends. Work hard in your social life. Work hard in your sports life. And enjoy it, and it will pay off.
Exactly. And it sounds an even important thing more is that you live the message, because kids don't always listen to what their parents say, but they do always watch what their parents do. And so sometimes just living your life with that enthusiasm for everything you do teaches them that if you're going to do something, you do it 100%, you give it your all, and you don't go halfway into anything that you do. And Napoleon Hill, one of the success principles is enthusiasm. And I think of the most successful friend I know, and that is the one principle that I would tie to him. Like, if he was selling shoelaces, I think he'd be the world's greatest shoelace salesman, because he has so much enthusiasm for everything. It's hard to say no to someone who is passionate and enthusiastic about their task.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. True.
Now, you've published three white papers, and one is Research 3.0, Neuroscience and Psychotherapy. And I've been reading more and more about neuroscience, and I gather you probably must use that a lot in your business. Neuroscience really allows you to measure people's instantaneous reactions to any creative output that people, lads, or that people are designing. And so the science, the emerging science of neuroscience and psychotherapy really does help you, doesn't it, pinpoint what areas of the brain are being used and what emotions are being generated almost like second by second?
It does. Tom, I'll tell you a little bit about neuroscience and its application in research. I mean, you know, in the true form, neuroscience is a scientific study of the nervous system. It truly is. You know, it's been used and collaborated with many other types of fields: chemistry, computer science, engineering, etc. And now, of course, within research itself. What we did was we truly studied a man by the name of Dr. Jan Pancek, who had done many years of research and designed many models around understanding neuroscience within research and the way the brain works. And then we applied that and built a shopping model around it. Now, you truly cannot measure neuroscience unless you have kind of, you know, someone going through an MRI machine and analyzing their brain waves to truly see, you know, how their brain's moving and reacting to different types of stimuli. So really, you know, what we did within this white paper is we looked at, you know, there's three parts of the brain, but we focused on two parts of the brain, the one being the limbic part of the brain, which really focuses very much on emotional processing. And then, you know, that obviously goes into rational processing, which is formulates back into the from the center of the brain outwards. And we try to correlate, you know, those kind of emotions to basically different stimuli and developed a number of different emotions around that. It was very successful in terms of us being able to develop this white paper and do a lot of beta testing around it. However, the uptake, and I have to be honest with you, in terms of the research world, has been pretty slow. And I think it's very much because of a misunderstanding. I think that our technology and the science is really not there yet in terms of the actual application. There are some research companies using it. We've done it quite a bit, but it's something that is not yet in mainstream, and understandably so. It's very, very new. It's very exciting, but it can be quite pricey, and the effects of neuroscience on research are not really that strong as most people believe it to be right now.
Right, but it has tremendous potential, doesn't it?
It truly does. I mean, the potential is actually quite scary when I can tell you, I know what you're going to do before you even do it.
Exactly. And I read some, I've been reading a book, I forget the name of it, but about online influence. And in there it said that your brain knows what you're going to do 200 some milliseconds before you actually do it.
Right.
And so also I was thinking that it's often hard for people to articulate what they think and feel about, let's say, an ad that's being developed. Whereas with neuroscience, the brain will tell you what parts are thinking and firing off, and even without them articulating it in words or how they felt, you can probably say a lot about how they responded to a particular ad just from the neuroscience and the activity in their brain.
Correct. Quite scary when you actually look at how much we can tell by that. But as I say, it's a pretty expensive procedure to do it properly, and I think there are some great research companies out there that just focus on neuroscience and its application in consumer research, and then there's companies like us that have tested it, done it, and for us, writing a white paper and truly understanding the progression of this type of science in research is fascinating. But at the end of the day, we do need to develop. We can innovatively and excitingly look at new products using new techniques, but we do need to develop products that have an application in the retail world and are actionable right now.
Exactly. Now, you mentioned a lot of your companies, Fortune 500 companies. Is there application for small and medium-sized businesses to use some of the intelligence that you gather as well?
Yes, no, of course. With mobile research now on the rise, and we're doing a lot of that, it is way, way less expensive than any other form of research. And I think that, given the opportunities that you can type of research you can do on a very regional basis now with applications and mobile devices, it opens up doors to companies and brands and organizations that don't have the huge research budgets to be able to engage in research on a much more cost-effective scale, put it that way.
Exactly, and more and more and more people are using their mobile devices for internet, and even one of the statistics in the book I started reading, I think it's called Webs of Influence, it mentioned that there's a good percentage of people who actually make purchases on their mobile phone while they're in a retail store.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't say whether they're purchasing what's actually in that retail store or if they're purchasing something else, but I thought that kind of funny, thinking of someone walking around a retail store and yet maybe purchasing something else from some other store on their mobile device while they're in the store. Or maybe they find a better price. They look it up online, they find a better price, and they end up purchasing it online, and they just use the retail store for actually seeing the product.
Mm-hmm. That's happening more and more. It's called showrooming, and we've done a lot of work around this because we have a number of retail clients who were like, oh my gosh, here we have our bricks and mortar stores,
mm-hmm.
and people are walking in and they are literally using their mobile to buy, and there's a term for it called showrooming. So we've done a lot of work around that, and we actually found that, it's not as bleak as retailers need to worry about, because a lot of consumers and shoppers today are using their mobile in store, and they want to use it for price comparisons, etc. And those that are shopping, actually making the purchase on their mobile phones once in store, are 14% more likely to actually return to that store, to look at something else or to make a purchase. So, to offer wireless free Wi-Fi in store, it's what most of us shoppers want right now. We're going to be on our mobile phone anyway, so just
mm-hmm.
give us access to it and provide us with our desires, needs, and wants.
And so another aspect for retail to consider, because as you said, in the past they got their brick and mortar, and they're probably one of their metrics is how many people pass through the store in a day. But now these people are not just passing through the store, but while they're in the store looking to see, is there a cheaper price on this around here? And I think of myself, like, I'm not so great at delayed gratification. So if I'm in the retail store and the price is like only a couple of dollars difference and I can buy it right now, I'm more likely to buy it right now unless there's a huge sale on it or a big difference in price somewhere else.
Exactly. So true. So, you know, you've got to catch your audience and they're in your store. You should be grateful for that. The amount of retailers that are fighting now just to get you to walk into their store, you know, the retailers should be grateful that they're actually there.
Exactly. And, you know, you can still build a relationship with people, even though they may be shopping you for price while they're in the store, but you've attracted them there. And so that's something about the marketing you've already done and about your products. And so getting them in the store is still a big metric. And as you said, free Wi-Fi. Geez, I was in Malaysia, and the Wi-Fi is not always great there, and the hotels was poor. But everybody remembered, oh, there's free Wi-Fi at McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this can be a selling point for someone. I need free Wi-Fi to do something. So let's go into this store in this mall because they have a big sign that says free Wi-Fi.
Yep, huge selling point for sure.
And you probably have to be within a certain distance of the free Wi-Fi. So if you can actually have them in your store while they're on your free Wi-Fi, even better. Now, you'd mentioned someone that you and your company have used as far as the study of neuroscience. Are there two or three books that just really, really made a difference to you in your thinking and in your career and in your decisions, maybe a business book or personal development book that you go back to from time to time to make sure you're following the principles and the things that you've learned?
Oh, definitely. Well, there's a number of different books. I think I would say, you know, the best book that I've ever read and still use today is a book by Vern Harnish, and that is called Mastering the Rockefeller Habits.
Oh, I love that book. Yes,
yeah,
Vern Harnish.
It's a brilliant book, and what's so great about it is that it's very, very actionable, you know, and it really talks about, you know, how to increase the value of your growing firm. But it doesn't just talk the talk. It actually tells you how to do it. And, you know, you can actually go onto a website, you know, his company website, and actually download certain tools. So I found that book really great, and I implemented a huge amount of their tools within my organization, from everything from, you know, annual planning, quarterly planning, to his planning pyramids and critical maps, etc. Another book. You know, so there's quite a few. So that one definitely I thoroughly enjoy reading. Rick Cash is a good writer in terms of how companies win, and he talks about, you know, consumer demand pools, as about, you know, how this world's changed from supply to demand and demand-driven business models. So those that was really good. Those are kind of two of the most recent ones. And then I really just, you know, I enjoy not just business books, but, you know, Malcolm Gladwell is one of my fabulous writers,
yes.
Tipping Point, and those kind of factual fiction books, if I can kind of call them that. But many, you know, in terms of, you know, the M Factor is quite a good book that talks a lot about the millennials, and that's by Lynn Lancaster. Smart Growth is another good book by.
Smart Growth. Who is that one by?
That's by Edward Hess, and it talks about, you know, building an enduring business, managing the risks of growth, especially for a company like ours that's, you know, grown, you know, nearly 500% in the last few years. So many, many great books out there, and, you know,
how about The Art of War? Now, because you wrote that book about no war in the world has been won without intelligence, and The Art of War ties into a lot of that as well.
I'm sitting here with the Art of War on my desk. you feel like you're in my office by any chance? The Art of War by Sun Tzu. Live and breathe that book, yes. Funny, I'm sitting on my desk. I have all the copies, and I'm just part of my book, obviously. James Clavell, he actually has edited and summarize a lot of Sun Tzu's writing, because, I mean, this was written, you know, I think 400 BC or something. Yes, The Art of War is a book that, without a doubt, it's not a business book, and that's what's so incredible about it. But it talks to the how you can apply war in a business setting if you truly understand the readings behind it and kind of the road to safety or ruin, etc. It was written, you know, 2,500 years ago in Chinese. But the brilliance of this, of knowing your enemy, knowing yourself, getting the result, being victorious, his military and tactical strategy, if somebody can take this book and apply it to the business world, is brilliant. And that's what I've done. That's what I've done in my book.
And how to, like, win a battle before it's even started. Just so many amazing things in that book. And when I ask entrepreneurs, like, that book is mentioned so often. And I remember the first time I read it, I thought, I'm not interested in war. I don't know the history of wars. Mm-hmm. But when you read it with a business mind, you think, whoa, there are so many applications in there for business. And just a powerful book that I think is on the in the top 10 books of so many entrepreneurs. And so if that's the case, that has to be a clue as to how good the book is.
Well, exactly. And hopefully mine will do it some justice as well. But yeah, that's absolutely, it's a book that's on my desk 24/7.
And so now, my dad had said in his life, he worked in the explosives industry all his life, and he said he never worked a day in his life because he just loved what he did. And so finding your definite purpose and your passion, something that you can be enthusiastic about every single day, that must make a big difference in your life. And not everybody, sadly, not everybody finds in their lifetime what is it that they are supremely passionate and enthusiastic about. Any ideas on maybe how people could find that passion, that enthusiasm, in their lives, and or how you did it in your life?
I think it's a journey. I think with anything in life, it's a journey, and you know, it's a journey. But at the same time, it could be a risk. So you can carry on doing everything you're doing day after day and be unhappy about it, but you have to continue to do it because you need to pay the mortgage and pay the bills. And you know, I need to continue to work at what I'm not enjoying, just so that I can enjoy more. That I can not enjoy more of my life doing what I don't enjoy doing. I mean, it's crazy, but that's true, right? So, you know, eventually you got to say, you know, hang on, I don't really care about this and that. I need to do what I love to do. And just, I was fortunate that it just kind of fell into place. I've always loved the marketing world, the dynamics of marketing and economics. I'm not a trained analyst and researcher at all, but it just fell into place. And as I started to get into this business and had a vision for how different I wanted to drive this industry forward and be a visionary in terms of not being a traditional researcher, I just began to love it more and more. So, you know, how do you do it? You know, I wish I knew, you know, the incredible rules for creating a, you know, being passionate about what you do. I think it's something that we all need. We all have somewhere internally within us, and some of us are able to find it, and some of us are able to pursue it, and some of us, for other factors, you know, unbeknown, are just, you know, just are not able.
Yep. But I really agree with what you said. It's a process. One thing I think about is that 80% of college and university students, 5 years after getting out of school are working in a totally different field. And then also you find people in their 40s, even in their 50s, that do something. They're actively involved in their community, or they get involved in a charity, or they get involved with something, and they say, wow, I really like this, and I have a talent for it. And so people should never give up on finding the thing that gives them juice, because you never know what nonprofit board or volunteer work or working with your kids on something that you're going to do in your life and find out that, wow, hey, this is interesting. I could really see myself doing this. And so I think it's to be actively involved in life. And if you're actively involved in various areas of life, you have more chance of falling into your passion and your purpose.
So true. I mean, never, never, never give up. Never stop wanting. But, you know, there's different people in this world. There are some people who are a lot more ambitious and career-orientated than others. And it's kind of, you know, it's irrelevant whether you want to be a, you know, the president of the United States or you want to be a painter in your backyard. It's what you love and what you enjoy that really makes the most of your life. And, you know, I always, you know, sit back and I always say, you know, what you visualize will materialize, and it's what you want. And if you constantly, you know, look for a dream of it, it'll happen. But you have to also work towards making it happen, and nobody can do that except the individual themselves.
Exactly, and you cannot always tie your job into your passion and your purpose. You mentioned painting in the backyard. Maybe you like painting houses, painting pictures. Maybe you're not always going to be able to tie your passion and enthusiasm into money, but you can work harder at your job to earn more money to help you fund what your purpose and passion or hobby is going to be for your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives more purpose to your work when you know, okay, I'm not just working for this paycheck, but I'm working so that I can go to this country and paint this, or I can study, take this course and become better at the painting, for instance. And so it allows you to, when you have that purpose and passion for something, to tie your job and your earnings into something that's going to make a difference other than just, I got to go to work today.
And have a live list, you know, have a live list. I have a live list. People call it a bucket list. I don't like the word bucket list because I don't really like taking the bucket.
I like that idea. A live list.
So have a live list of everything you want to do while you're living, and live it, you know. I have things on my live list that are, you know, some aspirations that I want to get to and do sometime in my life. And, you know, when you have that and you see it every day and you can read it every now and then and you can add to it, it gives you impetus to work harder and ambition to achieve it.
And I love that. A bucket list doesn't generate very positive emotions for me, but a live list is something to do while I'm living. So I think it's a much better term. So I'm going to make sure to start mentioning my live list instead of my bucket list. Well, thank you so much, Corinne. We could probably talk forever because it's a subject that fascinates me as well. So many tremendous accomplishments, and yet it still seems that you've been able to keep your life in balance with your kids and being a mom and running a successful business and finding time to do all the other things that are so important in life. So congratulations, and thank you so much for spending time today. I really enjoyed it.
I did too. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Have an amazing day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.